Hello, everybody. That's my music. Yes, this is Dr. Diana Wiley. Longtime listeners are familiar with my guest, Brad Coates. Counting my years on the air in Hawaii, and now 8 years, yes, 8 years on PRN. Just with this new year, it's 8 years. Brad has the honor of being my most frequent guest. Welcome back to the program, Bradley Coates.
Great to be back, as always. Has it been 8 years? My God.
Yeah, I've been on since 2010.
Amazing.
Actually, formally, it'll be 8 years next month, February.
Fabulous. Yeah. Well, congratulations on such a successful run, Dr. Diana.
Thank you so much, Brad. And then you may remember that I was on for about 5 years when I lived in Hawaii, and those shows went out to all the islands. And you were a guest right after your book, Divorce with Decency, was published, your first edition. You're now in your fifth edition.
Yeah,
Divorce
who can believe
Decency.
That, huh?
Yeah. So I saw an article about you in the paper, and I said, oh, I got to get this guy on my show. And that was the beginning of a long and lovely friendship.
That continues to this day, I might add.
Yeah, because Brian and I just saw you in Hawaii over Christmas, and that was a lot of fun.
You're always a lot of fun.
Well, so are
and
you.
I'm sure we're going to have some fun today, if I know us.
Oh, sure we will. We're going to talk about what men want, male needs, desires, and behavior in romantic relationships. Now, romantic relationships, Brad has agreed to return to this program the 13th of February. That's one day before Valentine's Day. So, Brad, we're going to save a lot of the romance talk for the part two on the 13th of February. But meantime, we're going to talk about the physical and emotional makeup of men, values and communication styles, physical and sexual differences, economics, and we'll make it interesting. We'll see how far we get with those topics. And they're all in your book, Divorce with Decency. Tell us about how you came to get a fifth edition of Divorce with Decency.
Well, I've been a divorce lawyer for going on 40 years now, and I run a law firm called Coates & Frye, which is the largest divorce and family law firm in Hawaii, and has been for probably 35 of those 40 years. So I've done, you know, literally thousands of these divorces. I think my law firm altogether has 11 attorneys working here now, and we've probably done 30,000 divorces. I personally probably done, you know, 8,000 or 9,000 of them. And after a while, you begin to start focusing on some of the root causes of divorce. And in addition to just doing the property settlements and the custody and the nuts and bolts of divorce law representation, I started to want to try and figure out more of what was causing all this.
Yeah.
So I started taking a look at, you know, how marriages work, why they don't work, how each gender is going to adjust accordingly. We did the last series that I've been on with you. We talked about what women wanted, and since women seem to be running the show a lot of the time, especially that is nothing like a president like Donald Trump to focus the issue on women. I'll tell you.
And then the Me Too movement. It's all happening. Wow.
Yeah. No, it's definitely, and it's happening in a lot more aspects than that. I mean, what's really happening is that women are taking such a predominant role in society as far as their earnings and income and clout within society, having stepped up so much over the last couple of decades. Women's liberation has been pretty successful. Not as probably as successful as a lot of women are anxious to see it go further, but it's made some major changes in the business community and in the marriage institution of marriage. It's one of which has been that women are the ones who most likely get dissatisfied with marriages and are most likely to file for divorce. About 2/3 of all divorces are filed by women. So you've got a situation really where the whole social institution of marriage is being set on its heels, and this is all an outgrowth of, well, there's tons of factors obviously, but you know, one of them is you know, women having gotten a little more strident and serious about expressing their own desires, which is long overdue, and men maybe being a little slow to respond. So I think we'll talk about maybe men's slower response a little bit today, and the last couple of talks that we had, like I say, focused on you know, on where women were going, and they are up and going, that's for sure.
That is for sure. So in terms of the physical and emotional makeup, by the way, listeners, I will, as I always do, I'll give you Brad's website, and you can get his book, which is excellent now in its fifth edition, Divorce with Decency, The Complete How-To Handbook and Survivor's Guide to the Legal, Emotional, Economic, and Social Issues. So you've got the whole thing. You know, Brad, you write like a sociologist at times, not just a lawyer, and I think that's refreshing. And even sometimes as a sexologist, you know, because you're interested in sex and you report it well, and we're going to talk some about sex today, as we usually do.
Well, I've got a ways to go to catch up with you as a sexologist, but it is... you know, certainly the psychology, the sociology, the demographics, you know, of what's happening to society with essentially, you know, the marriage, the divorce rate, I should say, has stabilized some, you know, probably the same old one half of all marriages ending in divorce as it's always been. But what's really changed now is the marriage rate has really, really declined severely over the last several years. And again, it may have to do with women finding it to be a less satisfactory institution than it used to was. It used to be that the route to success for women oftentimes was through their husband. He was going to be the breadwinner and the pillar of society and whatever else. And now that's not necessary. In fact, women are out earning guys a lot of the time. So it's women are in a position to go their own ways nowadays, and they are exercising it. It's especially true, Diana, with regard to remarriage. Yeah. I think both genders kind of are still wanting to get married. The bulk of American society seems to still want to get married. They've got everybody's got their sort of fairy tale dreams about marriage. They're holding off and doing it much later in society. It used to be that men and women got married in their early 20s. Now it's much more in their late 20s or even early 30s. But a lot of people still want to get married. But I can tell you this: when divorce happens to half of these marriages, there is a huge difference between the number of men that want to jump right back into a remarriage than there are women. Women, really after one divorce, they're done, and they don't want to be doing the cooking and cleaning and heavy lifting for another loser guy. And the guys, it turns out, really need the females. Guys turn around and get remarried as fast as they can find somebody, and women don't. So there's a major difference as far as the way the two genders are looking at the institution of marriage.
Absolutely, and even sexually, women who are in a satisfying sexual relationship live longer and are happier. But if they're not satisfied, and I think that sex, since it's at our sexuality, since it's at our core, it reflects a lot of other things. So women that are satisfied and enjoying their sexuality tend to be happier in a marriage, and their orgasms and all of that, and it leads to longevity, more longevity. But if they're not happy, then fuck it, they don't want it.
I guess you can say that on National Radio, huh?
It's internet, and. So, and it seems to capture the emotion of some women who just say, they've had it.
There's all kinds of studies that have been done that show that really the predictor of how happy, how well a relationship is likely to work out hinges largely on how happy the woman is in the relationship.
Yes.
Men will oftentimes just hang in there in relationships just out of inertia almost. So women will actually get up and move forward. And really, how happy a guy manages to keep his wife is likely to be a predictor of how likely the marriage works out.
That's very true. Now, Shel, in your outline, you first put for today's show what men want, the physical and emotional makeup, those aspects. So you say that men get a slower start than women do
even from the get-go. Yeah, even as young as young children, there's no question about that. Girls will start speaking earlier than boys will. A 3-year-old girl will have twice the vocabulary of a three-year-old boy. We've talked a lot about corpus callosum, that crucial connective nerve tissue that increases the connections between the left and the right brain hemispheres.
Right.
And women have got 25% more of that than males do. So they're better at multitasking. They're better, they're just better at coping in a lot of stuff. Guys, are sort of one trick ponies.
That may have evolved from an evolutionary point of view, because women need to multitask. For instance, if they have a baby and they're having sex, they need to be able to hear the baby cry. The problem is a lot of women still multitask when there's no baby. The baby's grown and launched and so on. It's harder for a lot of women to stay really present, especially if they're not really happy. To stay really present and to be able to let go.
Talking about sexually.
Yes.
Or just being in the relationship, I suppose. It is a huge issue. Women, like I say, they've got to, they've got to really feel it. Guys can, what's the old joke about guys doing it with a knot hole in a tree trunk or whatever? Guys are hardwired to just, physically get aroused, and once they're aroused, they're up and going, and and they can they're a little less selective about who the partner is. Women are much more selective about who the partner is, because the end result of now with birth control has changed substantially, but the result of a sexual encounter for women is a lot more serious an issue than it is for guys, who can turn right around and spawn a new offspring and another sexual encounter the next day. Women, once you make that decision as to who you're going to mate with, it's serious, and so they've got to feel right about it.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk about the values and communication styles, in the book I mentioned the fact that whereas female awareness is focused on communication, cooperation, sharing, relationships, male awareness is concerned oftentimes from a young boyhood on. It's concerned with, getting results, achieving goals, status, power, beating the competition, getting efficiently to the bottom line. And that is, that is true really as men, whether they're teenagers competing on sports teams or whether they're, young lawyers wanting to go from being an associate to a partner in a law firm, or work their way up the corporate ladder in any kind of business situation, and the guys' friendships oftentimes hinge around who their teammates were, who their office colleagues were. Women have book clubs and junior league and Zumba classes and all kinds of different circles of friends. Guys are, like I say, a little more down one, whatever track they're on, they're on that track. And again, that's something that is sometimes not very satisfying to women. I mean, women, especially as relationships grow and get older, women are looking to see their guys evolve. And guys don't evolve the way women do. It's just that simple. It's probably the single biggest piece of advice I can give to my male clients that are having problems in their marriages. You got to get a little more broad-based. You can't keep coming home being the same one-trick pony. She's got new needs and desires, and now she's got the money to finance them, and you better be paying attention, pal.
Boy, you give advice as a lawyer that I think most lawyers don't give, and I think it's really important. I just wanted to mention, if we go back to the last physical and emotional makeup, because I've got some interesting brain stuff here, and that's the presence of estrogen when we're being formed in utero focuses more on the development, developing the language parts in female brains. And for boys, it's testosterone. It zeroes in more on developing their spatial skills. So estrogen gives girls the language parts, and testosterone gives boys in utero spatial skills. And there are lots of jokes about men know their way around. I mean, I think about my own children when I have a daughter, as you know, and a son. And when my daughter was 16, she'd grown up in Palo Alto, and she inherited her grandmother's old Volvo. And she got lost in Palo Alto, even though she'd grown up there. Whereas my son, at age 3, we'd be driving around, and he was very interested in trains and anything that moved. And he knew exactly where the train station was, and he would point it out from his car seat in the back seat. train.
Yeah.
And he's always had good spatial skills. There are probably more architects who are males, maybe because of spatial skills.
Good point.
And did you know that there is a preponderance of left-handed architects, and that's because the right side of the brain, which is spatial skills, controls the left side of the body. Isn't that interesting? I mean, our brains are just amazing.
Yeah, the brain stuff is fascinating. I'm sure you know this book. It's right on point with what you were just talking about. This is one of my favorite books, and maybe your listeners, if they haven't heard of it, I commend it to them. There's a book, and the title says it all: Why Men Don't Listen and Women Can't Read Maps, by Drs. Barbara and Alan Pease. It's exactly what you're talking about with your Volvo story. And that book is fantastic on the brain, the biochemical brain structures of men and women.
Yeah.
I really
yeah.
recommend it. Why Men Don't Listen and Women Can't Read Maps, by Drs. Pease, P-E-A-S-E.
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 Oh, Pease, not T's.
Pease.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
And it's a great one.
Right. It started in the decade of the 90s, because then we finally had functional MRIs that could look at brains. So that was known as the decade of brain research, and then it's just done nothing but increase. So going to your second part of your outline, the values and communication styles, which you started to talk about. You mentioned that men love to hang with the boys, and I think, we know that men bond through common interests and activities. Oh, maybe it's shooting hoops, and not necessarily by talking, and you point this out in your book, too. So I recommend to my clients, especially my female single clients, instead of trying to pry personal information out of your guy over cocktails, when the pressure is on, save time for chatting about an unloaded topic, maybe like movies, and then catch up with him when you're doing something physical together. Because then he's more likely to listen if you're doing something physical together. Guys respond best to specific questions, like you mentioned you were grabbing lunch with an old friend. How did that go? Does that resonate for you? I mean,
yeah, that sounds like
guys?
That sounds like great advice. You ought to be a therapist when you grow up.
you know, I've been doing this now 35 years. That makes me kind of old, but quite experienced and wise, I guess.
Old and experienced is good.
Yeah, it is. it is. So, yes, so talk a little bit more about the values and communication styles. Because you mentioned that women have about 20,000 communication words, and go on about that a bit.
Well, that's one of the roots of the whole thing. It really is pretty amazing when you think about it. When you talk about communication words, it includes gestures, you know, raised eyelids, whatever, slanty looks, however, but women, 20,000 communication words and gestures a day. A man has only 7,000, you know, barely one, just over one third of the words and gesture, the output of women. So this is what women tend to identify the failing of their husbands and boyfriends. You know, oftentimes when they come into my office, you know, is their spouses, the male spouses, quote, reluctance to talk. And, you know, and the old joke is that the three scariest words in the English language for a guy are when his gal says, "Can we talk?" and he may not have a whole lot to say. Like you say, he might be better off going out and shooting some hoops, but he can't express how he feels. And women, like I say, go into these, they go through life, you know, they do their child rearing, and then they move on to, you know, like, you know, other interests. They continue to, you know, want to do yoga or, you know, book clubs and doing, you know, I mean, they're just constantly looking for ways to expand their consciousness. And guys tend to stall out as soon as they run out of things to talk about either sports or their careers. I mean, you know, you don't see guys wanting to really change the trajectory of their lives the way women do. Everybody's heard of Gail Sheehy's book, you know, Passages, and that was, you know, a classic book about, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago now.
30. 30 yeah. Plus, actually.
So what happens is, you know, again, guys being sort of hardwired from their earliest years on to be sort of single-minded competitors, well, you know, from caveman days onward. I mean, it was literally I was going to club the saber-toothed tiger. I was going to bring home meat for my mate. I was a warrior. You know, they don't waste a lot of time on downtime or introspection or emotion. So, you know, and that gets reinforced all along the way as men compete at everything from, like I say, making the sports team to climbing the corporate ladder. So you get to middle age, and what Gail Sheehy says about passages is, okay, now it's time to make a passage, some kind of move on to some kind of change. Guys don't want to really do that. They, you know, they don't want to make a change. They've, you know, they had the power and the glory, you know, in the early days, and they, you know, they liked being the male dominant guy, the in the corporate ladder, or with, you know, maybe with their spouses, which is what the, you know, Me Too thing is all about. Maybe they were a little too dominant with the women in their lives, but it's always worked for them. Women are just emerging. They're blossoming as they hit their 50s and even 60s. And guys, you know, making a change represents a pretty rough passage across, you know, mapping their adult life across time. It's, you know, it's not an easy thing for a guy to do. By the time he's 40 or 50, his job in the business world is becoming, you know, a little sketchier. You know, he's being one up by, you know, 20-something millennials that are in the tech world that understand stuff. And, you know, $200,000 a year junior vice presidents are being phased out in favor of, you know, five, you know, IT guys. And it's become tricky for guys. And they don't, you know, it's not easy for them to make the passage. The way Sheehy refers to it, Ms. Sheehy, is to, the essential part for men in middle life is to move from competing to connecting. Women at that point want to feel connected. They want to hear, you know, that what their spouse feels about, you know, life and philosophy and this book they just read, and you know, how they want to be told they're still loved, and you know, they don't really want to hear about, you know, why you should vote for Donald Trump. I mean, I personally am not, you know, as anti-Donald Trump as a lot of other. I mean, the guy's obviously a jerk, but you know, I think he's trying to do some stuff that may be useful for the country. So I'm not an anti-Trumper the way some people are. I certainly didn't vote for the guy, but mm-hmm. you know, I try to respect the presidency. But I'll tell you, this has in and of itself has driven a huge gap between the genders. I don't know any women that wanted to vote for the, you know, the Republican program. They don't want to be talked down to about by their spouses about why they should. And you know, guys were used to wearing the pants in the family, and then it, no more. Absolutely no more. So you've got a situation where guys are being out-earned economically. They're being told to grow up and forget everything from their stupid ass, you know, sports statistics to their political views, which are just not impressive to the Wahinis anymore. Wahini being Hawaiian for wife, or for not for wife, for woman.
So you've
got a situation where really it's caused a real wedge in relationships, which is going to keep divorce lawyers in business for the foreseeable future.
Yes. So it occurs to me, Brad, and you know how much I love you, but sometimes you're generalizing a little bit much on the guys, because there are some guys who are evolved, like you, like my Brian, and there are many other men who are evolved. And if we look at Carl Jung, he talks about the animus and the anima, and the animus is the male one part of our psyches, and the anima is the female part. And Gail Sheehy talks about this in Passages too. So somewhere after 50, for most people, and actually you talk about this too in your book, that many men do evolve. But
Guys have got to get in touch with their feminine side. I mean, that's really the anima and animus
exactly.
is a good way of putting it. And maybe I am overgeneralizing, because there are certainly the Alan Aldas and the Bryans, and hopefully the Brads, who try really hard to understand both genders. But there are a lot of guys that are, you know, tempted to stay stuck in their ruts. And why wouldn't they be, right? I mean, they've always been the boss. They've always, you know, had the higher earning jobs. They've always had the, you know, the power and the glory. And as they get older, that gets stripped away from them. You know, all of a sudden, you know, you're a retired, you know, partner in a law firm instead of, you know, the case winning, the Supreme Court briefing power, you know, partner in the law firm. It gets you all the, you know, the kudos. So retirement becomes difficult for guys. I mean, that is certainly one of the two biggest times for divorce. Again, from my divorce lawyer's perspective, are the first year after the last youngster leaves home, i.e. the empty nest syndrome, and the first year after retirement from your jobs, where you've really, now you got plenty of time to sit there and stare at each other and go, okay, now what have we really got left? So those are big issues. And like I say, women make that transition a lot more fluidly than guys do, and guys have a hard time with it.
Yes, because
some guys, right. I mean, I'm overgeneralizing some, but I mean,
no, but
you know,
I'm generalizing
bear it out because it's the women that file for the divorces.
Right. But in general, men are more identified with their work than women, you know,
correct.
And so retirement can be much more difficult. Women have, even women who now have careers, but women, but men, I used to be identified with my work more. I was Mr. Vice President of such and such, and now I'm not. And so I, 30 years ago, I worked with Dr. Walter Bortz, a geriatrician in Palo Alto, and we published two studies on aging and sexuality that were later published in medical journals. So that's how I got to be a gerontologist. But Dr. Bort said that he would sign death certificates for men who were 65 or slightly older, maybe as a heart attack or whatever. But he said it really had much more to do with depression and anxiety, which may have brought on the heart attack or perhaps cancer, because these men were a bit adrift. they didn't have their work anymore. And going back to Gail Sheehy, I love what she said. Don't retire, redirect. It's so important to stay engaged in life, to feel useful, to feel necessary. And that's a problem with retirement.
Yep, no question about it. No question about it. And, and you know, it is, it has been shown that, men are more vulnerable to than women to mental illness and self-destructive physical diseases following divorces, for example. That's why men rush to get remarried right away. Men generally take divorce much harder than do women. They've got higher rates of mental illness and suicide. And one of the problems, and this is right up your alley, Diana, is men are far less willing than are women to seek any kind of professional counseling.
Yeah.
So if you are trying to cope with depression and or any of its ancillary effects, you know, and if you can get to a therapist that can help you get through it, you're ahead of the game. But again, that's something women are more likely to do than men.
That's very true. I get lots of women calling me and saying, I'd like to bring my partner in, my husband in, but I'm not sure I can drag him in.
But he won't come. Yeah.
We've got problems. And sometimes then I'll see her for a couple of sessions, and then I'll say, okay, have your guy go to my website, get familiar with me on the website, including the little YouTube thing where I'm talking. And then if he wants a brief phone conversation, that can happen. But sometimes I can do couples therapy without the other person there, but it's difficult. You know, we need both people there.
I don't have the exact statistic in front of me, but I think I've read somewhere that women are like 10 times as willing to engage in marriage. From my perspective, again, I don't always tell people, hey, you know, okay, you came into my office, you want to get divorced, bang, let me make some money as a divorce lawyer and get you divorced. I always, you know, almost always anyway, unless they're really determined, I almost always try to suss out what the cause of it was and if there's any chance of not having to get divorced. I've saved lots of marriages in my divorce law office.
And that makes you exceptional, Bradley.
It's relatively rare.
Yeah. It is. And then you use some of your MO when you go on cruise ships and talk about, tell us, let's digress from the outline a little bit and tell us what you talk about when you go on cruise ships.
Well, it turned out to be kind of a funny second career for last 15, 17 years or so since the first volume of Divorce with Decency was published in 1998 or 19, I think they put 1999 on it, but and then five editions later. So I got to be fairly well known as kind of a relationships guy as a divorce lawyer. You know, not all divorce lawyers focus on this. So the cruise ships, I was doing TV and radio and stuff to hype the book, and the cruise ships picked me up and they put me on as their relationship lecturer and life enhancement or life enrichment lecturer. I was doing that for Princess Cruises. They were kind enough to send me around to like 140 countries for free, just flapping my jaws on their cruise ships for the last 17
140.
Years.
140? Wow, I didn't realize you were that traveling much.
I've been around, Diana.
I knew that, but I didn't know about the cruise ship part of it.
But what I was starting to say earlier is, you know, if I am trying to, you know, quote, save a marriage before I just start processing the paperwork, and I suggest marriage counseling to the clients, the women are far more likely to have tried it or willing to try it than are the guys. The guys are going, I don't need that. I don't need that. And counseling is a good thing. I get more women that buy my book than guys do. I mean, you know, they just guys oftentimes they just don't think they need to know anymore, or they don't want to. Like I say, you can sort of understand historically the way it's evolved. I mean, the guys had all the power and the glory and the, you know, they were the top dogs in society for centuries, and all of a sudden they start seeing it pulled away from them. And, you know, you can imagine why it's a little difficult for some guys to cope with that. And especially now that women are starting to out-earn them, because that's the, that's the radical change that has taken place now, is that, you know, that American women are outdistancing American guys substantially in professional status and achievement. I mean, you know, here's a quick statistic. Women's earnings went up 44% from 1970 to 2007. You know how much males went up? This is women going up 44% in that 30-year period, 37-year period.
Yeah, what was
guys
the male part?
Guys went up 6%.
Wow, 6%. That's quite a discrepancy, quite a difference.
So that's, you know, one-third of all married wives are better educated than their husbands nowadays. You know, almost 60% of bachelor's and higher education degrees are going to women. When I was in law school, there were like 10 Wahinis in the first year law class that I was at UCLA. It's totally, totally changed. The wife is now the main breadwinner in 22% of all U.S. households. That was, you know, that used to be 7% in 1970. So, I mean, you've got a situation where guys are being somewhat emasculated, and I don't mean that in a condescending way, but I mean that's the best term for it, you know, from what they used to have going for them. And so you've got a situation where guys are having to really kind of pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and try and keep going. Now, there's another interesting aspect of all this, is that guys who can manage to age gracefully, stay in their marriage, men are now, in contrast to women, actually getting happier as they get older. Guys who are able to live their kind of entrenched, you know, all I need is my lazy boy lounger and, you know, an E-SPAN on TV and I'm in a couple of beers and I'm a happy guy. Mm-hmm. You know, they're reasonably happy. Women have got a much longer laundry list of what they expect out of life. Sometimes they don't always get it. Sometimes as they step into the working world and they get all the promotions and the maybe the bigger salaries, but they also get the stress of having to work their okole, which is Hawaiian again for ass, off at the office, and then come home and still do the lion's share of the housework, which is still the case. You know, they're sometimes a little less happy about life.
Sure, and you've got some statistics about the amount of time that typically women spend doing the work, even though they might have a job.
Yeah, I do. The average working woman spends 102 minutes per day caring for her family versus 48 minutes per day for guys. So less than half. And this is, you know, this was maybe one thing while the wife was, you know, the stay-at-home mom or whatever, and, you know, and the guy was bringing home the bacon. But this is now with both halves of the party in the working world, and yet the women are still expected to do, you know, more than half of the work. Globally, 38% of all men don't do any chores at all. You know, in a liberated society like the West, like America, the rest of the Western world, it's turned out to be a little fairer allocation of labor, but I'm not sure if you go to Asia or the Muslim world or, you know, some of these other areas that, you know, where the wives are still, you know, maybe a little more subjugated. You know, you've got a situation there where the wives are still expected to do everything and the guys, you know, literally just, you know, don't do anything.
It's shifted a lot, and you write that historically marriage was the surest route to financial security for women. Nowadays, it's men who are increasingly getting the biggest economic boost from tying the knot. Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, you already have, but just a little more precisely.
Sure. Let me go back to what I was saying before, that, you know, about how this is a phenomenon of the Western world. I mean, you've got to realize that more than half of the people in the world live in countries where having a second or third or even a fourth wife is permissible.
The fact
that we have moved towards monogamy and marriage and the empowerment of women in our society, you know, that hasn't really caught on in the whole rest of the world.
Right.
Anyway, the part about you know how hard women are working, and how much the equation has changed is definitely true. I mean, it has been a situation whereas historically women instinctively thought, you know, for the protection of the resources and the genes of successful men, That's changing. Now women can, you know, now women can have boy toys who are 20 years younger than they are. If, you know, if they're the corporate maven, they can have their personal trainers or whoever they want, and they can basically steer their own lives whatever direction they want. So
the roles have reversed.
It may be that marriage nowadays has actually turned out to be more. In fact, it seems to be that marriage nowadays has turned out to be more of a positive for males than it is than it is for women.
Yes, it would seem so. It would seem so. In terms of. We're still on economics a little bit, but I like to tie economics in with sex because I like to tie lots of stuff in with sex.
You like to tie everything in with sex, right?
Yeah, I do, because
and don't
I
we
just
all?
Love
yeah.
sex, and I'm a sex therapist, and so on and so forth.
Well, there's an internet. I'll let you go in a second because it is your show, but there is another body of evidence that really advocates for the importance of sex therapy and understanding. You know, when you do get couples into couples counseling, there is a body of evidence that shows that if you can, quote, fix the sexual part of a I won't say broken or, but a iffy marriage. If you can bring that back into line, and this is, I guess, what sex therapists are for. At least as far as the men are concerned, you've got a pretty good chance of putting that marriage back on track. Literally, sex is so important to males that if you can fix that and maybe get that, I think marriage counselors routinely report that if they can successfully fix the sexual problems for their couple's clients, they can oftentimes bring at least the husband back into the fold. And
that's
maybe
true.
You are doing something useful after all, Diana.
So the point I wanted to make that ties sex in with economy or economics is a 2015 study found that sex once a week was the optimum amount for maximizing marital happiness. The Canadian researchers, and I love Canada because they actually get funding to study sex and pleasure. The U.S., we don't ever get funding for anything around pleasure. It has to be problems around sex. Anyway, the Canadian researchers who analyzed data from three different studies found that sex played an even bigger role than money in happiness. How do you like that?
I can totally believe that. When you say sex one time each week is optimum, does that mean that two times is too much?
No, not necessarily. No, you and I wouldn't say that.
So a minimum of one time each week is
optimal. Right, but that's optimal. That's optimal. Anyway, the difference, according to these studies, the difference in life satisfaction between couples who had sex once a week and those who had it less than once a month was bigger than the difference between those who had had an annual income of $50,000 to $75,000 and those who had an annual income between $15,000 and $25,000. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So it plays a lot of importance in happiness in a relationship, and it goes back to something that we all know, that money does not bring happiness.
Well, that is definitely true, and there's been all kinds of statistics that show, the recent studies are that anything over 75 grand a year is basically neutral, anything above that. You need a certain amount to get by and feel stable and not be traumatized about where your next meal is coming from, but you do after you get to a certain level, you don't need 75, you don't need 750,000 anymore, and you need 75,000, and that's
exactly.
So
there's a toast in Spanish, and I love it, and I'll say it in Spanish, and then I'll translate it because I think it captures some very basic philosophies that are important. And it goes like this. And I'm raising my water glass as I speak. So it is salud, amor, el dinero, el tiempo para gozarlo. And that means to health and to love and to money and the time to enjoy all. Because, think about it, if you don't have health, then it's really hard to have love. And if you don't have health and love, then it's really hard to enjoy your money, because the last part of that toast is the time to enjoy all.
And how did you say that in Spanish again?
My Spanish is not great. Any Spanish.
Salud, amor, dinero, and what was the rest?
So it's salud, y amor, y el dinero, y el tiempo para gozarlo.
Oh, wow.
The time to enjoy all. Isn't that a great toast?
Yes, I love it.
Yeah.
I wrote it down.
Good. Do you speak some
Very
Spanish?
Very cool. I took French in school, which was probably not the smartest idea I ever had. When you realize that Spanish is now the second language in the U.S., it might have been smart to have learned Spanish.
But have you been to France? As a young man, I bet you used your French.
A little bit, yeah. When I did on the cruise ships, and I can fake Spanish if I have to, but one thing that, you know, when we're talking about sex, you know, it's not just sex, as we all know. If sex is handled, so to speak, correctly, sex is probably one of the most intimate forms of communication that you can possibly hope to achieve in a relationship. So that kind of intimacy is high on a woman's list, and a guy's too. I mean, you know, sex and communication is wonderful when it's going right, and it's something not to be underrated. I think it's been shown that sex is especially important to guys. I think the statistic that I've got is that some 60% of men, but only 35% of women, say sexual activity is important to their lives. Guys are totally hardwired for sex and reproduction. And I don't ever mean to talk down to women, but I think, you know, one of the things I do tell my clients is that if you've begun to think that sex is less important to your marriage, you may want to think again, because for guys that stays a pretty important aspect of it. And I see these couples come in where they, and sometimes it works for them, I guess. I mean, I think there's an awful lot, you would know better than I would, Diana, but there's an awful lot of married couples for whom sex has just really gone by the wayside altogether. I get clients coming into my office all the time in the divorce end of the spectrum. Maybe it's just gone on too long, where they say, you know, we haven't had sex for 3 to 5 years. You know, we've been sleeping in separate bedrooms. We do, you know, I mean, you probably can speak to that better than I can, but that's
no, you can speak to it just as well. And I of course see that. And the huge red flags. It's very difficult. Sometimes in the first session, I'll ask them, "How did you meet? What did you find attractive about your mate?" Because I want to find out if there's a foundation. You know, if they're so estranged, and they hadn't had sex for years, I want to know about it. If there was a foundation, was there a beginning for this relationship? Sometimes couples get to be friends, and sometimes they even lose that, but too much friends, like sisters and brothers, and they lose the erotic edge. And Esther Perel's book, Mating in Captivity, speaks to this very well. It's an international bestseller. I recommend it. But, you know, it's very hard to keep eroticism and friendship in a marriage or in any kind of a relationship. I think that when we still have time for this program, but I think when we have part two, the day before Valentine's Day, February 13th, which Brad has generously agreed to do with me.
I can't think of anybody I'd rather spend my Valentine's Day with than you.
Oh, it's so sweet. I might even have Brian, my fiancé, future husband, call in just for a little 15 minutes of toward the end. That's I haven't presented this to him yet, but I think he'll agree to it. Wouldn't it be fun to talk to Brian on the air about what makes true romance?
I'm going to ask him what he originally found attractive in you.
I know it. I know the answer already.
But that's I wrote that down too. I always take notes on our conversations because that's something that as a divorce lawyer who sometimes tries to save marriages, you know, that's a great thing to bring up.
You must have
liked him at one point. How can we hate him so much now?
Yeah, exactly. And you need to find out if there is a foundation on which you can, I mean, as a therapist, you as a lawyer, you know, can we build on this or not? Is it just too much over with?
Well, one of the most astounding things to me in 40 years of doing this job is how people can have been in love with somebody that they thought they were the one person in the world they wanted to be with, one year, and then some years later, literally hate their guts and want to destroy them. It's astounding to me, the combativeness that is in a lot of my divorce cases, as you can imagine, is staggering.
Yeah,
literally
so
just
what,
they
what
get
do
to the
you
point where
about?
They literally despise one another, and it's just almost hard to fathom.
So, yeah, but what do you, so you've seen lots of couples like this, and they're so, of course, they're in your office, and they're they're really in the fight mode. They're combative. What do you think are some of the reasons that couples have devolved into this?
It's the old joke about, love and hate being, two ends of the same spectrum, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it really is. It's bizarre to me because I've never really experienced that personally. I don't hate a lot of people, period.
No, you're
and whatever
a good guy.
Whatever relationships I've had have usually ended, fairly friendly personally. But
sure.
I'll tell you, there's a lot of people, and I guess maybe when kids and money are involved, people get even more, even more combative. But it is bizarre to me because you're doing nothing but hurting the kids by having these big, major fights go on. I mean, now the latest thing is where everybody accuses one another of abuse and, oh my God, it's horrible. I mean, for the kids to come home and say, okay, your dad's now in jail because I, swore out an affidavit claiming he'd abuse me. I don't know how the kids or anybody adjust to that kind of stuff. And then once
very, very damaging for children. Because it ultimately, they have insecure attachment, and then that affects their adult relationships hugely, where they have trouble trusting. And and believing that somebody can be good and follow through on stuff and be responsible and all of that. It's very sad for the children. And when I'm talking to a couple that's about to divorce, I'll often suggest divorce mediation, which I know you do, and maybe you even suggest it outside. But there's about 35 years ago when I was in Palo Alto, I worked with Dr. Isalina Ritchie, and she wrote a book.
Oh, I know her, Mom's House, Dad's House. Yeah.
Mom's House, Dad's House. It's a classic book. It's a very good book.
Yeah.
She was
an icon
custody.
In the field. And mediation, I'm a trained mediator, and actually the Divorce with Decency, that was the name of my book, was actually the title for a mediation clinic that I started, back in the early 80s. I've done hundreds of divorce mediations, and it's by far a smarter way to go. In fact, for your listening audience, and this is kind of off topic, but you know,
no, it isn't.
Mediation and alternative arbitration, what they call ADR, or alternative dispute resolution, is almost always smarter than going through the court system or actual litigation. So I would commend that to anybody that, you know, whether it's, you know, trying to argue about, you know, a lemon law in a car, you know, in a new car purchase, or, you know, fighting with your neighbors who's crowing roosters, or, you know, I mean, just, you know, try mediation first.
And it's so much better for the children.
Yeah, yeah. Divorce is definitely better.
Combined with that aligned with that are Judith Wallerstein's longitudinal studies. You probably know her name, Judith Wallerstein.
Oh, yeah, she's in my book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right, she is. So she, in the 70s, got a huge grant from the Ford Foundation, and so she was able to do these longitudinal studies on children of divorce. And she found that parents who continued to co-parent, I'm just saying this for our listening audience because I know you know this, but who continued to co-parent, parents who continued to talk about their children even though they were divorced, the children did better. And if they had a custody agreement where the children knew when they were going to be at mom's house and dad's house, and it was posted, that was important to them, and also that the children were not meant to be message carriers, and parents didn't talk. What's the Hawaiian word for bad?
Stink. Yeah, talk stink.
Yes, stink,
yeah.
About the other. That's really devastating for the children because they already have divided loyalties. So all of those things are really important.
Well, Dr. Wallerstein's work has been taken to heart by the court system. I mean, that's the trend in custody nowadays is to try and strive for joint custody, including joint physical custody, where you literally have the kids half time between each parent, which was anathema in the old days. In the old days, it used to be. I remember when I first brought a joint custody decree in front of a Japanese judge, he refused to approve it. This is 35 years ago. He said, "How can you possibly have these kids going back and forth between both households? You know, there need to, you know, in those days the emphasis was on stability, and you needed
Brad,
to have
we're ending sooner than usual,
but
the
we'll
good
be back
news
on
is
the 13th.
We get to hear more from Brad Coates the 13th of February. Thank you, Brad.
Like Arnold Schwarzenegger, I'll be back.
Good." Excellent. Bye-bye, everybody.